Okay, so if we start with non-personal equation, and they look like pressure constant, three wedge omega c.
So this is an arbitrary big group. This is an Maurer-Cartan equation. And we have the the connection omega transforms inhomogeneously. These group elements, we'll see the generators produce dimension that by G inverse minus DG. G inverse. So there's the general transformation property. Now, we generalize the connection to give curvature. And we're going to have now d omega minus a half. Of course, this is not technically speaking the same omega, but I'll write it the same way. Just to save alphabet symbols. So we add some field strength or curvature two form, however you want to think about it. But the Cartan structure equations become this. So the field strength or curvature is given by d omega a plus 1/2 a structure constant times a pair of connections, 1 point. So our goal is to prove that thing is a tensor. So let's do a gate transformation, see what happens. R tilde is going to be d of all this chunk, g, let's put a ga in here, and then I'll simplify this in a second. We have 1/2 dB dA omega C wedge omega C GA. In fact, this can be written as a commutator, right? If I have omega commutator omega, that looks like zero, but it's not, because this is a linear combination, omega A wedge omega B, it's actually just omega squared. You don't even need the commutator here. If I write omega squared, then omega A wedge omega B GA GB, pulling the G's off. And I can write that as 1/2 omega A wedge omega B commutator GA GB. And that is a structure constant, so I can write this as C ABC omega A wedge omega B GC, which is exactly the same. So I could write that term as omega squared. I should think whether I want to. But yeah, you know, that might be a way to go. So R tilde, the new R after we gauge transform. I'll go ahead and take derivatives here. So I have a dg omega g inverse plus d omega g inverse minus g omega dg inverse. The first term. Then plus dg wedge dg inverse. D squared, of course, is zero. And then we have, let's see, we want omega tildes here. So this term I can write as omega tilde squared, and that's g omega g inverse minus dg g inverse squared. We rearrange things. Now, you can go back and do this with as many indices as you want, but, you know, this, oh, like, at least half the time this works. I think we'll be okay here. We have to sort out this product. Just don't interchange things, because you've got generators and group elements attached, so don't change order of things, and this calculation goes through in this form. So, any question what I've done so far? I'm just writing R tilde is the omega tilde plus omega tilde squared. And then I'm substituting in for omega tilde. Okay, so we have R tilde is dg omega the inverse plus d omega the inverse minus g omega d of g inverse plus dg d g inverse plus, okay, so now we've got g omega d inverse, g omega d inverse. The inside g's go away. G inverse g gives me 1. So I just get g omega squared g inverse for the product of first term. Then we have minus g omega g inverse dg g inverse. Then we have minus dg g inverse g omega g inverse. And finally, plus dg, g inverse, dg, g inverse. And this pair gives 1. And then we have a dg omega g inverse. That's the same as the first term with the opposite sign. So that term cancels the first term. Other terms, we probably have to do some rearrangement to get things to cancel. Let me see. Do we have the right number of terms here? Yeah. Thank you. Let's collect the two terms we want. We've got g quantity g omega plus omega squared. G inverse with these two terms. They combine. Yeah, that's right. Then let's bring these two over. G omega dg inverse dg dg inverse. Now, this term I want to integrate by parts. Notice that I can write g inverse dg is d of g inverse g minus d of g inverse g, the product rule. And this is this term is zero. That product is one, D is one to zero. So I can throw the D over onto the other with a minus sign. So I want to do that on which term am I looking at? On this term. I want to put the D over onto that G inverse. So this term becomes plus G omega D G inverse G D inverse. This term, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to have minus dg dg inverse g g inverse. And now the gg inverse factors go away, and you see that things cancel quite neatly. What remains here cancels that. And these two cancel, leaving us with G, and then D omega plus omega squared, that's the original form of the curvature. So this is just R, and it transforms to the second right. There.
Okay.
Any questions? Is it, now, I could have called R F, so, or G or H, any of the field strengths in these Yang-Mills series that we've been talking about, so the standard model, this applies to all of those. I didn't make any assumption about the group except that it was a Lie group and that we used our gauge construction to produce curvatures. So we always get answers. Notice that the curvature is zero. The Maurer-Partin equation holds, right? If that's zero, then the Maurer-Partin equation holds, and this pure gauge form, dg g inverse, is a solution to the Maurer-Partin equation. So, if R equals zero, then omega equals minus dg d inverse solves the Maurer-Partin. So when the spacetime is flat, or when the field strength is zero, then the gauge field is pure gauge. That is, there's a gauge transformation that will make the gauge field be zero. So, there is a gauge transformation that will make this quantity go away.
Are we saying omega zero?
What's that?
Are we saying omega zero?
Yeah, omega. Alright, so, let's see. So if we transform by C, omega tilde. Yeah, so there's a gauge transformation that makes the connection zero.
I was saying, are we letting omega equal zero in this part? Or that omega equal zero?
Let me see. How do we see this conclusion? Let me be a little more careful here.
Omega have to equal, don't remember.
I'm trying to think if it. Yeah, it seems like we've actually done enough work to show that, but not seeing how it jumped out at us. Maybe the simplest way to see that that's the case is to just substitute that form for omega into the Yeah, but let me not say it this way. You don't have to transform by b. For each choice of group element, you get a different form for omega, right? Changing group element changes omega to that. If you just have the Maurer-Cartan equations without any curvature, it's straightforward to just substitute this in and see that you have a solution. Right? That's all. Let's see. Have we done that? We've substituted more than that in here. I guess. If we go to, say, let's see, 2G. Yeah, if we go to this step after we've done the substitution, and we set R equal to 0, and we set omega equal to 0, everything that's left is what would have happened if we just substituted DGG inverse for omega. So every term here that doesn't have an R or an omega in it. So just this one and the product of those two is what you would get if you set omega to minus DGG inverse in the Maurer-Cartan equation. So just the balance between this term and that product. Well, we did that here and here. Those are the only terms that you would need to get this result. So the fact that those two cancel is showing this line.
Okay.
Yeah, it's way simpler than that.
Okay.
I knew it was in there somewhere.
Also, I mean, same thing, but if you put omega equals minus DGG inverse into that first parenthesis, then you get D of 0. That term goes to 0 by itself.
Omega is a negative DGG
inverse. So, really, the goal is to solve that equation in that case. And so, just try to substitute minus DGG inverse into that equation. You did that one integration by part. But nothing aside, this is just the group you have. Hope that clarifies it.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about this too as well, so.
Yeah. So you can see that from that one step that'll work. Any questions on this then?
I have a question about the electroweak.
Yeah.
When we did that, we really only ever used SU under 2.
Yeah, so when we chose a gauge to simplify the Higgs field, we just did an SU2 transformation.
Okay.
We could have done a U1 as well.
We know that there was an SU, had to have been, well, at the end, we needed it to be U1 cross SU2 because we had 4 gauges both on. We had 4 independent things,
mm-hmm.
and we chose one of them to be the photon. Well, the one that was independent of those.
The one in the Atlas combination at the end.
Was the photon, and the other 3 were the weak field bosons.
Mm-hmm.
What stops us from just somehow adding in SU3 to the whole thing? What's the after seeing how simple that looked, it seems like it should be straightforward to have SU3 in there as well, or to gauge.
Well, SU3 is in there as well, but what do you want to do with it? What is it you're trying to accomplish? I mean, the standard model has SU3 in there, right?
Right. But come up with a way in which they all come out of the same thing, and 3 of them have mass, and the other 9 don't.
Right. Well, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 does that. Right? We do accomplish that. I mean, we've written, I think I wrote this trial action that had them all together, and we've modified that a bit since. But the final thing we write is that? I mean, if you don't couple the Higgs particle to the FG3 gauge boson, then, you know, they're not going to acquire mass, and this is exactly what you get. All right, so we're doing that. Now, if you wanted to look at an FG5 model and say, well, what couples here, and what do we want to predict for the masses, right, these, you know, they call the off-diagonal things, if you have an FG3 up here and an FG2 down there, and there's one extra diagonal that gives you one, but then you've got X's and Y's, they're called, here, and then some sort of conjugates down there. Okay, these are going to be really massive, because we don't see them. Right, so now you've got six more gauge bosons that you've got to give big masses to. So now, yeah, see if you can couple those to the Higgs. Well, you've got to be careful that it doesn't couple to the FG3. So you've got to leave all eight of these massless, and you know, presumably there's a way to do that. Right, that would be the kind of thing you need. You might need more Higgs fields to do it. The masses of these are substantially higher. If these exist, the masses would be substantially higher than the W and Z masses, because we don't see any evidence for those in accelerator experiments yet. In fact, proton decay mitigates against this whole theory. But yeah, that is the kind of thing you'd like to do in a unified theory. And if you look at the literature in the 70s, there was a different grand unified theory every week. You know, there were lots of grand unified theories. So pick any group that contains FG3 across FG2 across FG1 as a candidate for a unified field theory for the strong and electroweak interactions. The thing you need to do is make it predictive. So you don't want to pick something like E8 cross E8 because it's way too big. Well, that's what string picks. One argument in favor of string theory, in fact, is that it does pick a gauge group. Now it says, oh, it's got to be E8 cross E8 or SO32. There are only these two choices. If you're doing string theory, there's actually a reason to consider some particular group. You know, by 1994, people were really tired of all the different unified theories. How do you choose among these? You want some principle that says, hey, look at this group. And, you know, string theory provided that. That was, you know, a very exciting thing in that historical context. But really, you'd like something tight where, you know, you're not predicting a whole lot of stuff you've never seen. You know, you're predicting, you know, a few things you've never seen, and, you know, tight relationships between all of the elements of the theory. I mean, the thing that's so good about the FG5 theory is that it could be falsified. I mean, that's a real argument in its favor as a theory. Unfortunately, it came out wrong instead of right, but, you know, that's the danger you face if you actually try to make predictions. You know, happily electroweak worked out just right. They predicted the not mass, and there it was. Right, we're predicted. Derek. Question? Joe was asking about the history of this. Utayama, Yang Mills, the original Yang Mills theory, when was it 54? I forget the year of that paper, but Yang Mills wrote a non-abelian gauge theory for FG2. Basically provided, I imagine when they wrote it down, it was the theory of isospin. So they, you know, saw the proton neutron as a doublet and wrote an FG2 gauge theory to accommodate that near symmetry. And it turned out to be a good description of the weak interaction. Utayama in 56 wrote down a gauge theory, U1, FU2, FU3, and Lorentz as the theory of everything. You know, it's a piecemeal theory of everything. It's a product of a bunch of groups, but pretty much covers the ground. It gives you convincing evidence that gate theory is a nice way to think about these things. So it was in that context that Weinberg and Salam developed the electroweak theory. Up until Weinberg and Salam, right, we already had a gate theory of electromagnetism. U1, gate theory of electromagnetism, was developed by Hermann Weyl in 1930. In the early 50s, you have Yankee Mills developing a theory of the weak interaction, and lots was being found out about that. So the electromagnetic and weak interactions were described already by U1 cross SU2. The difference is that in the non-unified electromagnetic and weak interactions, the U1 was electromagnetism, the SU2 was the weak interaction. The two were not coupled, except you could multiply the two groups. What Weinberg and Salam did was to take that same gauge group, U1 cross SU2, but to not assume that U1 was electromagnetism and SU2 was the weak interaction, just that those give you four gauge bosons, four gauge fields, and among those gauge fields you expect to find the electromagnetic potential, the photon, and the three gauge particles responsible for weak interaction, but at some linear combinations, which indeed is what we found once you couple that picture to the Higgs mechanism, which was developed, I think, in the 60s, early 60s, maybe. Coupled that together with the Higgs, and boom, out pops three massive gauge bosons and one massive photon. So a beautiful piece of predictive unification. And, you know, once that worked so well, everybody was writing grand unified theories. They were popping out all over the place. There are some groups that are better candidates than others. You know, like G2, you know, the exceptional group, but really good for this. SU5 and SO10 were very strong candidates. E6, I think, the exceptional group E6 was a good candidate unification. It still is, since string gives an E8. This seems to break an E8 to an E6. Since the development of ideas about supersymmetry, it turns out that the exceptional groups are closely related to supersymmetry. As we heard last fall in the Tevian and Perrin's lectures, the Norm's division algebras really underlie supersymmetry from an algebraic point of view. And they also are intimately related to the exceptional group. And so those are good candidates for unification or a piece of the puzzle. So, let's see. Electroweak, what other questions? Can we pick up where we left off? Do you have any questions about what we covered last time? I was looking at the notes and the normalizations and things worked out nicely. I think the notes give a pretty clear presentation of what we covered last time.
But E8 doesn't have enough room?
Oh, E8's got tons of room. It's got like, what, 248 generators?
It doesn't have enough room for grand unification.
Well, it's got loads of room for grand unification.
There was a brand new paper that came out. Like a week ago. You didn't see this?
No, what is this?
I guess, you know how Lisi is the surfer?
Yeah, sure.
And he repopularized the E8, and there were some mathematicians who are rock climbers, and they proved somehow in this paper, I've got it printed out, that there's not enough room for gravity in E8.
According to Lisi's
approach, right.
Yeah.
So the big joke is rock paper scissors or rock paper surfboard, rock deep surfboard.
Good.
Well,
you need to conform across.
Yeah, there was a problem.
Oh,
right.
There
was a problem right off the bat with Greenpeace's approach to gravity. And I'm not convinced that EA doesn't have room for gravity as far as that goes. You know, it depends on how you interpret the H field. One thing Leakey did was to try and come up with a generator for every particle in nature. You know, just everything was, you know, one of the gauge fields of EA. Well, you know, it's got, what, the 248 gauge fields in it. It's a huge group. Of course there's room for gravity in there. Or, you know, if you look at the killing metric of EA, you know, if it's got a minus sign anywhere in there, you could embed SO31 into the EA. So it's not that you can't get, you know, the gauge theory of the Lorentz group out of that. Leakey gave a very tight interpretation of each gauge field. Not a lot of room for play. And it's quite possible that that won't work. That what he assigned an SO31. He found an SO31 that he was going to make into the gauge group for gravity. Well, right off the bat, my thought was, well, sorry, the wrong gauge group. You want the conformal. You need SO42, or the covering group, which is probably what you get from the aid of the telling group. But, you know, I mean, there certainly is one in there. The question is, you know, how it falls out, and, you know, whether you really want to base your theory just on EA. The EA and string theory doesn't have this problem, by the way. EA cross EA in string theory emerges as an internal symmetry. So you can imagine. Like I said, I haven't seen a proof that this is exactly how it falls out, but bosonic string theory is takes place in 26 dimensions, and superstring theory takes place in 10, at the difference of 16 dimensions. And if you imagine compactifying 26-dimensional bosonic string in such a way as to get a 10-dimensional theory with some internal symmetry, a Kaluza-Klein compactification of the bosonic string theory, where you compactify in the right way to get some large internal symmetry, and then this super string theory in 10 dimensions, that internal symmetry group would be exactly the size of either SO32 or E38. There's a good chance that's what's happening, that what you're seeing is, yeah, you know, in any case, the superstring theory has this internal symmetry, EA. And so, in that model, you do not interpret EA as giving rise to gravity. It's the rest of the string theory, the 10-dimensional string theory, gives you gravity. And you, in addition, have this internal symmetry, this huge internal symmetry. And all you've got to get out of it is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 to accommodate the standard model. Well, that's a big test, and you have a lot of symmetry breaking to do, and there are a lot of ways to do it. But interesting stuff. One model being contradicted doesn't make a gauge group bad. You can go back to Gavile's theory of his original theory of electromagnetism before he said, oh, let's make this U1. He was doing biogeometry, convinced about geometry. He added one gauge field for dilatation to general relativity. And he said, hey, this transforms just like the electromagnetic vector potential. Let's interpret this as electromagnetism. Well, something's wrong. It means that, you know, hydrogen atoms would be all different sizes. Well, that doesn't mean that violent geometry doesn't describe nature. What that means is that the violent vector is not the vector potential. So, a different interpretation of the violent vector, what we find in research is that the integral of the violent vector along the curve makes an excellent candidate for a particle action. Right, which also has that same symmetry. You change the Lagrangian by the gradient of a function, and it leaves
action invariant. Well, that's also exactly the right symmetry for the Weyl vector. Changes by a gradient under a gauge transformation. So that theory actually works beautifully for a lot of things. So when you think about a gauge truth, okay, you've got to keep track of, you know, what is the interpretation that someone is putting forward as the candidate model, and okay, is that right or wrong? That doesn't mean that you throw out that gauge truth. I'm going to write paper reserve for it, that's quite possible that these interpretations is not the way to go. EA, on the other hand, might be a great unification group. We'll see.
I think you have to take certain subgroups engaged by it, is that right?
Sorry, what?
If you have a subgroup like EA, you have to take certain subgroups from it engaged by it. That's what we're talking about, right?
Taking a quotient of EA by a subgroup? Let's see. That's what I would do.
Okay.
I think that's probably not what Lisi was doing. I'm not sure how they break it in string theory. The main breaking mechanism in string theory occurs in the gravity sector, where you're reducing a 10-dimensional string theory to a 4-dimensional effective space-time theory. So you have to compactify 6 dimensions. And compactifying 6 dimensions is going to break a lot of symmetries. You know, could very well give masses to a bunch of the EA gauge bosons. I'm not sure what happens to those internal symmetries when you do certain things to the space-time scale. Breaking EA to a standard monosymmetry, there are probably a gazillion ways to go. The simplest is to go to the old V6 model of unification that people were doing some time ago. How do you break a symmetry? You can use a Higgs-type mechanism to break a symmetry. Spontaneous symmetry breaking, as I was mentioning last time, almost any solution to any theory breaks the symmetry. So all you have to do is, reduce the energy and, see what things couple, and you'll get composite particles that will break symmetries, and you can get an awful lot of solutions out of a big theory. So, other questions? Let's see. So, we're back to electroweak. And now, there's more to the story. So, we've succeeded in giving the gauge bosons the right masses. So far, so good. There are two other issues we need to deal with before we get our standard model in respectable shape. We need to give different masses to the quarks and the leptons. Right, the electron and the neutrino don't have the same mass. The up and down quarks have masses. So, have different masses. If all of the quarks and leptons had the same mass, be done with that part, but they don't. So we've got to come up with some mechanism for giving them different masses, and we can do that using the Higgs particle again. There's a coupling to the Higgs that'll work to introduce masses, different masses for those particles. Unfortunately, it introduces a lot of parameters into this theory, but that's okay. It accounts for what we see. The other problem we have to deal with, and it turns out that the best way to do this is to deal with this one first, is the parity violation of the weak interaction. So let's back up and take a look at how we might violate parity. And it hinges on the couplings that we have for the various particles. This is the reason I was stressing these various Lorentz tensors you can construct from bispinners, the current that we get in these Yang-Mills theories are all vector currents. Let me write down what I mean. You'll see what I'm talking about. But the Yang-Mills coupling are of the form of a gauge field. We've got some gauge field, say B, I, alpha, and then we've got some generator, and that acts on some kind of a spinner doublet. And then over here we've got probably some constant and a phi bar and a gamma alpha. So these are, how do we write this? Di alpha. And then we have, okay, let's put G over 2 here. Coupling constant, and then we've got a phi bar, gamma alpha, we need the tau I in there, and phi. And this is a current. There's one current for each generator, and each one is a Lorentz vector. So this is just like E&M, right? In the E&M action, we have A alpha, J alpha, where J is the electromagnetic current and A is the gauge field. In this case, it would be the U1 gauge field, but now we realize that that's actually a linear combination of B3 alpha and B alpha, the U1 and the FU2 gauge field. But we always have this pattern of gauge field dotted into some current. So, if you remember, we had identified phi bar, gamma, alpha, phi as a vector. So what we have is a vector current, right? Vectors conserve parity. The simplest way to muck up parity is to add a pseudo vector. So if I take something like psi alpha gamma alpha plus beta gamma alpha gamma 5, right? Gamma alpha gamma 5 is a pseudo vector. This would be a parity violating current. And it keeps the current of vector, vector, pseudo-vector, except for violating parity. So this is a good candidate. Now, this is not by any stretch the only candidate people looked at. I've written down, all right, there's a tensor interaction, there's a pseudo-scalar and a scalar. I mean, you know, to violate parity, you've got to have either the pseudo-scalar or the pseudo-vector. And it turns out that this is the right thing, that this combination with alpha and beta of equal weight is what works. Current for the weak current needs to be of the form psi bar gamma alpha, and then okay, so take alpha to be 1 and beta to be minus 1, or let's pull a half in here. So alpha equals minus beta equal a half. So we get a half and we get a 1 minus gamma 5 psi in here. So this is the vector psi bar gamma alpha gamma 5 psi is pseudo vector. Or axial vector. An axial vector is one like angular momentum. R cross P is a vector along an axis of rotation. That's where that name comes from. But this is the difference between a vector current and an axial vector current. So this is called V minus A. The V minus A interaction, or V minus A theory, V minus A current, vector minus axial vector. What it is a left-handed current. Notice 1/2, 1 minus gamma 5. That's the thing we've stuck in here, right? 1/2, 1 minus gamma 5. The reason for the 1/2 is because that makes it a projection operator. This is, and we saw this before, this is a left-handed projection operator. So we only have left or right-handed particles coming into this. Well, it'll turn out that we'll want left and right-handed neutrinos, but remember that the electron, and similarly the muon and the tau particle, participate in the electromagnetic interaction, and that has to conserve parity. So we have to put these left-handed projections in judiciously so that essentially they're only hitting the neutrino asymmetrically. But we'll see how to do that. Let's check that it's a projection operator. So it has to be idempotent. So if I multiply the thing times itself, it better come back to itself. That's the test for a projection operator. And if I multiply this out, I get 1 minus gamma 5 minus another gamma 5 plus gamma 5 squared. And gamma 5 squares to the identity. So, indeed, we get two of those. We get two identities, and the extra factor of 2 gives us the projection operator back. There is an orthogonal projection. Any guess what that tells?
Right-handed.
Right-handed. Space, that one's a projection operator too. You just put plus signs in here and it'll square out to itself. So, you know, we can call this R, we can call this one L if you like. And notice that R plus L is the identity. So they span the whole space. So we can divide the space into right-handed things and left-handed things. Also notice that they're orthogonal. If I take R times L, 1 plus gamma 5 times 1/2, 1 minus gamma 5, I'm going to get 1 minus gamma 5 from the 1 here, and then we get plus gamma 5 minus gamma 5 squared. But this could cancel gamma 5 squared to 1, so this is identical to 0. And it doesn't matter which order you multiply them in. So they're orthogonal to one another, they add up to one, so they span the whole space. It's clear we're dividing the space into two subgroups. And we've seen that, in fact, these correspond to particles whose angular momentum vector points in the direction of their motion or opposite the direction of motion for a massless particle. That's easy to track through from the Dirac equation. We did that at one point. It's somewhere in the notes.
two
okay.
of them.
Yeah.
Is there, does it matter which one's right and which one's left?
No. That's the definition. When we're talking about a massless particle, take the right-hand rule, the angular momentum, if it points in the direction of motion of the particle, then the particle is spinning this way. That's the rotation axis,
mm-hmm.
angular momentum axis. And for a left-handed particle, if it's going that way, it's the opposite sense to the spin.
Okay.
So, but at some point, that's a definition. If our hands were on the other side, we'd call it something different.
It's my right hand.
Are there approximately the same number of two different types?
Well, for the electromagnetic interaction, they're exactly the same number. It's preserved, and you can find the same number of right-handed and left-handed electrons. For neutrinos, we only find left-handed neutrinos, except that they seem to have mass, so that's not really quite an invariant statement. But if neutrinos were, in fact, massless, then they would be of definite helicity and, according to the standard model, would only occur left-handed. So there would not be symmetry in those. Now, the antiparticle has the opposite, handedness. So an antineutrino would be a right-handed thing. And yeah, sure, there are as many neutrinos as antineutrinos in a sufficiently hot place, like the center of the sun. Yeah, you can probably get above, except that there's a preference there for matter over antimatter, so then you've got a... There may be an awful lot of antineutrinos coming out of neutron decay. I'm not sure which kind of neutrinos come out of fusion. That may be antineutrinos too. So, you know, there might be too many antineutrinos and therefore right-handed things. But that depends on the production mechanism. If you were in a scenario like a particle accelerator, say, you know, we're at the LHC, where we're colliding protons with antiprotons, the number of right and left-handed things coming out of that ought to be equal. There's no preference for particle or antiparticle in that kind of situation. So at some level, there's a total symmetry. But for the neutrinos, for massless neutrinos, the particle is left-handed and the antiparticle is right-handed. We'll develop that theory first, and then we'll look at the end about how to put mass for the neutrinos back in. We can do that, so that'll work out okay. Now, the thing we have to do in order to get the electron, but not the neutrino, to preserve parity, is to treat the left-handed and right-handed stuff differently. So, the neutrino occurs as part of the doublet. There's a certain magic that happens here, and it involves the Higgs again. So, there's one more reason that this Higgs doublet is really nice, and you sort of hope they do see it, because something's going to get complicated if they don't. But I'll come to that. The neutrino is part of the doublet. Okay, so the electron neutrino is the isospin down state of the electron doublet. And now what we want is for these to be left-handed fields. Okay, that's fine. You know, we just whack the projection operator, minus gamma 5, onto each of them. And that's fine. Now we've got our left-handed electron and left-handed neutrino. This hits each of them, because that meant you two doublet, not a Lorentz doublet. So that figure space just hits them both. But we also need a right-handed electron. You know, we need that in order to get electromagnetism to preserve parity, but we don't want the right-handed neutrino. So we have a left-handed doublet That's an SU2 doublet. But we have a right-handed SU2 scalar. So we're gonna bring these fields in. One is a singlet, one is a doublet. And this is gonna work nicely because what happens is the reason we have the doublets in the theory was to get the coupling to the SU2, which is, all right, that's the W and V particle. It's also partly the V naught and partly the photon. So what's going to happen here is that only this doublet is going to couple to the SU2. And then both of these will couple to the U1. This works out okay. You write the weak action putting in the gauge field. So now our Lagrangian for the electroweak interaction, we just make this change. All right, so we go ahead and let these couple the way they're supposed to couple. So doublets, the covariant derivative will involve the SU2, and singlets, you won't have that SU2 part of the covariant derivative, but otherwise, things look the same, and let's see what happens. Let's write this thing out. Let's see, do I want to put this in? Before I write the action, I want to introduce another term. Yeah.
What physically is the right-handed electrode?
It's the other half of the electrode. We want the whole electron field. We want the left and right-handed parts of the electron spinner to come in equally weighted. So if we have a term in an action that's the sum of these. So suppose we have something like, our current gauge field interaction, right? We're going to have a di alpha tau I, and then there's a phi bar here, and we've got a g over 2 coupling. What else goes into this? There's a gamma alpha, and then there's a phi. Well, so what's going to happen is this is going to become a left-handed thing. So J I alpha is going to become this thing. And let's see. You don't actually have to put. There are several things I should say here. The conjugate here, if I have phi L is a half 1 minus gamma 5 phi. Suppose I take phi L dagger. Well, all right, that's going to be phi dagger, and then the dagger of all this is the same operator. Because gamma 5 dagger is gamma 5. So that means if I take final bar, I'm going to have gamma dagger 1 half 1 minus gamma 5 gamma 0, right, is the bar. And if I bring the gamma 0 past that, gamma 5 anti-commutes with all the gamma matrices. So this becomes phi dagger and it becomes phi bar 1 half 1 plus gamma 5. You think, that's going to kill everything. But it doesn't. Because the current has a gamma alpha in it. This gamma alpha turns it back into a gamma left. So, looking at all of this, if I write this left-handed current as a coupling constant, prime r left, gamma alpha vi alpha tau I psi left. That's equal to g over 2, and then we just show that phi left bar can be written as phi bar with a half 1 plus gamma 5 on the right. Then we have a gamma alpha d alpha I tau I psi L. But now, bring this past the gamma alpha, and it's going to turn that gamma 5 back into a minus gamma 5. So the gamma alpha on this side gives us a half 1 minus gamma 5. These fields are living in a different space. And then psi L. Well, that projection on a psi L just gives us psi L again. Right? This psi L has a 1 minus gamma 5 already in it. So you're getting a 1 minus gamma 5 squared, and it just reduces to the same thing with only one of the particles written as left-handed. All right, it commutes past this tau I. Left projection on a left field gives a left field. And so we only need to put the L subscript on one when we write the current. Some details to check. You know, it would have been bad if this had come through as a 1 plus and killed the left-handed thing. So we need all that to work out right. But it's done. Now, so we expect to see terms like this in the action. We are going to need to introduce both of these kinds of terms with whatever couplings are appropriate. Let's see. Just wondering what happens to the
this looked right a little bit ago. What do we have? Just the B.
Basically, a Higgs field gives you the three constants. The Higgs field is gauge invariant. You know, you write it in the covariant derivative, and so everything you do with that Higgs doublet is going to preserve your SU2 symmetry. But then, once you start solving the field equations, the Higgs is going to sink to that constant value or near it, and give you the three constants. You can stick into the action wherever you need it. Well, one place we need it is to give the electron a mass when the neutrino doesn't have any. So what we introduce is the Yukawa term, the Yukawa interaction. What you can have is, remember the Higgs is a doublet. The left-handed things are doublets. And if the right-handed things had been doublets, we would have been in trouble, but it's a scalar. So what we can do is we can take the inner product of the two doublets. If we had three doublets, there'd be no way to combine them all into an overall scalar. But if I multiply ER times E left and, or E right bar times E left neutrino left, so I take the product of these. This is a Lorentz scalar. This is equal to, right, E bar right, E left, and E bar left, E, or right, E left. That's a Lorentz scalar. And it's a an SU2 doublet. And now we can take the inner product of that doublet with the Higgs. So phi dagger E right bar E left E right bar new left is going to be, right, it's phi 1 conjugate times E bar right E left plus phi 2 conjugate with E right bar new left. That's a double scalar. That's a scalar, that's a Lorentz scalar and an SU2 scalar. So we can stick that in the action. Alright, a term like that can go in the action, and that invariant under SU2, invariant under Lorentz transformation, we get them both. So, add terms that look like this. Let's add some g for each lepton. That's just a constant. And then the phi dagger and e right bar e left. All right, that's the Yutawa term. And, well, this is the one for the electron. Right, and what's that going to do when the Higgs achieves its vacuum expectation value? So when phi is equal to that constant nu and zero, then, okay, what happens here? This term drops out, and GE phi dagger E bar R E L becomes equal to just this term, where that phi star is just nu, E right bar E left, and that's just a mass term for the electron. So times G. You can write this back in terms of the real field, and it's just the square of the electron wave function. So, the electron spinner. So, introducing a term like this, using the fact that ER is a scalar and phi and EL are doublets, then the Higgs mechanism, boom, gives you a way to give any particular mass to the electron you like. So, this becomes mass of the electron. Right. And each term we add to this form just adds a mass to that particular particle. So we add one of these for each lepton, and now we've given the electron and the mu and the tau particles their mass. We end up doing the same thing for the quark. We end up adding terms like this to the quark. There's another complication in that there's mixing between all the different quark states when they couple with a weak interaction. And if we want to give neutrinos mass, we have to use the same kind of coupling here. So there's one more matrix that we have to stick into these terms. You're all looking too sleepy to introduce the whole new concept today. I won't try and do that. But let y'all take a breath and ask any questions at this point.
Is there a new phi for every particle?
No, there's only one Higgs.
Okay, so there's a new...
There's exactly one Higgs delta.
So there's a new G for every particle.
There's a new G. That capital G is an arbitrary constant for each particle you want to add that.
Okay, but you only need one phi for every... Quarks do, or is that a different field now?
Quarks do, yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah, it all comes from the weak interaction and, you know, this kind of term with the Higgs.
This is the same Higgs as...
Same Higgs. Only one Higgs.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, you know, you only need one to do it all. You can couple that same Higgs into everything. It feeds that same constant into everything. But then, since you can just add any multiple of that term, then you can just throw it in with whatever, you know, the mass divided by that Higgs constant, and you've got it. So the trick is getting, you know, we've added one particle with a potential that breaks the symmetry. And now that one case of broken symmetry we can use everywhere we need to break the symmetry. Well, it's a cheap and dirty trick, right? You know, there could be 20 particles that have potentials like the Higgs that break the symmetry. And they could all be coming in differently. You know, there could be one for every particle of the standard model. If it has a sufficiently high mass, we haven't seen it yet. Well, so then the question is, does that help or hinder? If there were 20 of them, would their masses be higher or lower than the mass of the single Higgs? There are some strong constraints on what that constant mu has to be at this point. You know, it really needs to be within the window of the LHC in particular. So if it's there and this is the right way to do it, you know, then they should see it.
It's not the same new as over here, right?
I'm sorry. That's the neutrino.
Right. It's different news, right.
And that's that should be a V.
Oh, okay.
Right. This is a V. And it's just a real constant, and people call it V. Yeah, that's better.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just some real constant. You only need one to bring all these terms to life. Well, you can see that there might be other ways to do it. It doesn't have to be scalar. You know, you could couple these left and right fields to to some other spinner. You know, there are various ways that you might imagine coupling these fields together. You know, you could have some interaction involving four particles, and, you know, two of the particles, form a condensate that does this. I haven't explored a lot of ways that you can do this, but, you know, apparently people who work with the standard model all the time aren't too concerned if the Higgs isn't seen, because, you know, there are other ways you could do this. This is just the simplest one, and it's, you know, Occam's razor, right? Until you can disprove this one, let's go with it. Once there's more data, figure it out. I was thinking today that the standard model has held up really well. You know, the standard model has been with us now for 40 years. I don't think Maxwell's theory lasted that long before there was contrary evidence. You know, Maxwell wrote a book summarizing his stuff in the, 1880s. And, you know, 1900-whatever, you get plonk, and, you know, radiation isn't fitting the curves right. Well, that's not so bad. But then you get relativity. Well, all right, it's Lorentz invariant, so that's not really a problem. But by 1910 to 1920, you get De Broglie wavelengths, and people are trying to build models of atoms. It was really Einstein in 1905 who took atoms seriously and tried to really explain things in terms of them. And once that started happening, people started trying to build a model of the atom, and Maxwell theory falls flat. So, you know, well before 1920, it was clear there was a serious problem with Maxwell's theory.
Well, and then pretty soon we had QED and all that, and things got picked up. But, you know, a 40-year run without any serious contradiction is still pretty amazing. And when you add to that the fact that between, say, 1880 and 1920, you know, Maxwell's theory was probably tested about, you know, a millionth the number of times that the standard model has been tested. I mean, you know, you're getting a collision every billionth of a second on these particle accelerators. You know, each of those is in a sense a test of the theory. So the amount of testing that modern theory undergoes is really much more than, you know, people would have been doing at the turn of the previous century. So it's a pretty remarkable accomplishment. It's very durable theory.
Yeah, but how readily can we get an energy out of one of these expressions? Is there energy in there?
An energy? Well, these particles, you know, in a scattering collision like a proton-proton collision, they're really producing free particles. So a free particle can have any energy you want. One of these particles at rest, you know, the energy is the mass. So in that sense, we're getting an energy. What were you getting at? I'm not quite clear about your question.
Well, we get a mass for an electron, and the mass is an energy.
Yeah.
So
here we're going to choose that constant big G sub E, so that the product G times V is the mass squared of the electron. So we measure the mass of the electron, and it's input to the model. So when we write our final standard model Lagrange density, we can write that G sub E in terms of the known measured mass of the electron. It's input to the model. It's not a prediction. And actually, that's where most of the parameters of the standard model come in, because you've got to give masses to 6 quarks and at least 3 of the leptons. That's 9 parameters right there. And, you know, what other parameters do you have? You've got the coupling constants, G and G prime. You've got the strong coupling constants. You have, in your Dirac actions, you've got some mass parameters. But it comes out to about 20, 21 parameters, something like that, altogether. And then from that point, everything in the standard model is predictive. And you handle it just like we've been doing the quantum field theory. That's the point. Just like we did QED, there are more interactions, there are more diagrams to draw, so it gets tricky. But the electroweak calculations can be done. The couplings aren't so strong that that you don't get reasonable convergence within a few terms. So you can make predictions there. And it's suppressed by the masses of those gauge bosons. So, yeah, that makes electroweak field theory calculations fairly straightforward for a lot of scattering. So, have you got this? We could press on, or we could go back and expand on what I've said today. The thing about the standard model is there's so many dependent ideas. You know, it's like field theory in general. You know, there are all these little bits that you now pull them all together and get your final picture. Can I expand on any of these elements?
I think so. I think I'm forgetting now. But this one of mine is gamma 5.
Yeah.
Was there a presentation using 4x4 matrices where it was like 1, 1, 0, 0 on a diagonal? Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was, I'm not sure that's exactly what it was, but there was a representation where you pluck out, you know, it was like a diagonal representation.
Right, right,
And you could see that, Oh, let's see. How does it work? If you took one of these left or right-handed ones, remember how we divided the Lorentz transformations into two copies of SU2? And, one acts on one combination of the fields and one on the conjugate. Well, it's these projections in that basis you're remembering split the field into a part that the SU2 left and the SU2 right. Actually, one of them acts on one just like spin, and the other acts on the other just like spin. So you could see that. Then they rotate in opposite directions. You can just see all the detail of the left and right handedness from that basis. In fact, that's the easiest way to do it. Yeah, check back to the notes, because I actually remember doing those transformations. I wrote it in that basis, and then I actually did a rotation and showed, oh, see, this is only responding to this one. Forget what I had to do to get there at this point, but if you go back and sort of halfway back this semester, I think when we were talking about Dirac particles, solutions to the Dirac equation, you'll find it.
Is
More? Shall we write all the Lagrangians?
Let's write the Lagrange. Let's write the extra week Lagrange.
Big long thing. And then we'll expand it. Center fields are doubling. Then we're going to add
the Higgs. So what we want is the covariant derivative squared term for the Higgs. Now, writing that out is this long, nasty, ugly thing. It's, you know, I could write it, let me write it this way. It's, take the dagger and d beta. A typical kinetic term for a gauge doublet, so that takes a couple of days in sight of week-wise. And then we have a whole mess of terms, some over lepton, and a g appropriate to each lepton. And we have this doubling down here to the Higgs. What's the simplest way to write that? I guess that up there we have phi dagger and phi bar lepton right-handed coupled to phi left-handed like that. Quick question, is that zero? Why can we couple a right-handed and a left-handed particle that way? It's a bar, not a dagger here. Right? So there's a gamma zero between them. And when you move the right projection past the gamma zero, it changes to a left projection and it's okay. So this is exactly the one that's not zero. Okay, so let's see, I forgot one term. We need the Higgs potential, which we can write as some multiple of pi squared minus b squared. That thing squared. That's our quadratic and quartic potential plus some constant that doesn't matter. So here's the whole structure. That's not for that. You've got your gauge field squared in the usual way, the curvatures. You've got a massless Dirac action for everything, except we've had to put in these left doublets to get the symmetry breaking the way we want. Then we've got our Higgs particle action here, and then we add the Yukawa terms to give different masses to the different leptons. So, not too bad to understand. Now, if we start to write this out, let's just write out one term at a time. So, suppose we look at this sum on leptons of I phi L B slash phi left. Okay, so what does that look like? Well, okay, so there's an I, no problem. We have a sum over the electron doublet, the muon doublet, and the tau doublet. And then, okay, so each of those we're going to have a phi bar. And then we have, well, pull out the gamma alpha, and we have a covariant derivative. So let's write out this covariant derivative, and then we'll see the coupling to the various particles. So, what is it? D slash of phi left. Then we have I over 2 times the coupling constant. I pulled out the gamma, we've got a B, J, alpha, tau J, sum on J, and then that acts on the left on. And then we have the coupling to the U1, the hypercharge G prime, C alpha. We can put in a value for the weak hypercharge. I forget what that is for the left on, but I have to look that up. But, there we go. So this term expands to something like that, and now you see, all right, here's the usual kinetic term for the Dirac particle. But then when we bring this here, this is B coupled to an FU2 current, and this one becomes the alpha coupled to a U1 current. So we see those interactions. Let's see. Now, the right-handed ones are the same. The difference doesn't show up yet because, okay, these are doublets
and I haven't made them explicit doublets, but each of these is going to be something like E nu or mu nu for the muon or tau and the tau neutrino. But when we write the same thing here for the right-handed one, there's just the one field, just the E or mu or tau, not the neutrino. And that's okay, because the neutrino is only a couple weakly. You know, I'm wondering whether... Now, we're going to have to expand this out all the way to really see... the thing I'm a little concerned about... let me write out this... I'll show you what I'm fretting over a little bit, whether we need to tune something up here. But, all right, we have a term, sum over the leptons of pi psi right lepton, and then we have the covariant derivative of n of psi l right. Okay, those are scalars. So this one can be written as I, sum on the L, we have a psi bar right for each lepton, and a gamma alpha. But now we have a derivative and of psi left and right. And then, all right, since it's a singlet, not a doublet, we don't need this tau term. The tau term is the connection appropriate to a doublet. But, so only this singlet term shows up. We have an I over 2 G prime D alpha hypercharge and phi left on right. So here we see that we only get a coupling of the right particles through this D alpha. Well, the two things that involved the V-alpha were the V-naught and the electron. So that's okay. That you know, the V-naught could be left-right symmetric. But the thing I'm worrying about, remember that the photon is a linear combination of the FG2 gauge field and the V-alpha. And I'm worried what's happened to the right-hand piece of the electron wave function in that combination that gives the photon. So I'm not seeing at this point exactly how that's going to work out. So I need to expand that and see what happens. What else we got? We've done the Higgs in detail. That's fine. We've got this mass term over here. So you know that's basically the electroweak action for the lepton. The one thing we're going to need... Okay, so there are two questions. There are two questions I want to answer. I want to be sure that the electromagnetic interaction ends up being parity preserving. That has to be the case. So we need to expand this and check that. The other thing that's a concern is that the there is some mixing here. Right? The neutrinos can morph into one another. And this action doesn't allow that to happen. What happens in, okay, say this interaction term. All right, this doublet contains a neutrino field, and that's going to get mapped into some anti-lepton over here. But what happens is that, you know, typically you'll couple an electron and an anti-neutrino, and so you see those coming out in neutron decay, and those will be coupled for the W.
or you have neutral currents with the V-naught. So the W plus and minus, those currents have electric charge. V-naught currents don't. But the natural way to first think about getting the neutrino, the neutrinos to couple to each other, right? This is a sum of terms over the different neutrinos. There's no term in here that mixes the electron neutrino with the muon neutrino. So you could put some additional matrix that, you know, couples, you know, say an L prime here, some mixing matrix that accomplishes that and allows those neutrinos to interact. That's not actually the simplest way to do it. The simplest way to do it is to do it over in the mass matrix, where you put a matrix in here that allows coupling between, say, electron type stuff and muon type stuff and tau type stuff. So that, I don't even remember the name of that. That's a new matrix. That's fairly recent. I think I might have written it down. And then again, maybe I didn't.
So are a couple of those? Are we going to have a whole family of neutrinos? Some of them massless and some of them massive?
Probably not. It seems most likely that the electron neutrino is extremely light, but not massless. It's not determined experimentally. Its mass has to be less than 10 eV, so very, very light. But certainly the other two need to have masses. So we've only got the three neutrinos and their antineutrinos. And since we see transitions between all pairs of neutrinos, there have to be mass differences between them all. It'd be a little funky if it's possible to model. I mean, you could model a massless electron neutrino and a massive mu and tau neutrino. You could do that as well as you can give them all mass. It seems to me likely that, you know, eventually people will be able to do a subtle enough experiment to measure the electron neutrino to have a mass of a, you know, a, who knows what, a tenth of an eV or, you know, something small. It hasn't been seen yet. But, you know, right where you expect the mass to be, it gets really hard to do the experiment. So it's not reached yet. But the method that's used is the same as the method that's used to allow the quarks to interact right with the weak interaction. We haven't talked about weak interactions with quarks. I just okay, well, there's going to be this interaction term. Well, we know what the interaction term should look like for the quark. So let's take a quark 5R, and, you know, we're gonna the derivative has to be covariant with respect to SU3, but now it also has to be covariant with respect to SU2. So we're going to have an ID slash psi quark. So we'll have something like this. And then it gets a little funky because we expand this out as psi bar, and then let's just write a covariant derivative for SU3. I'll include the partial derivative in that term. And then there's one more interaction term that involves the gauge field of the weak interaction. So we're going to have VI alpha with our tau. And what happens, well, you know, V should be left-handed as well, so we have a left-handed quark field in here. We've got a coupling constant. And the problem is, if you just add a term like that, let's see, have I got it complete here? Yeah, this is enough to see the problem. We're also going to have the G prime term, I bar, Q, B,
alpha these interact electromagnetically, so you're probably going to try the same trick and put my right turn for the singlet. And you're going to add the common turn. So you're going to have a G for the, say, the up quark, a G for the east quark. And what happens? You've got the Higgs shovelet coupling to phi bar right, phi left for each quark that you want to give mass to. This is almost the right form, except once again, you sum over all of the quarks. So there's no term here that includes both the, say, the down quark and the strange quark. Right? The down quark couples to the up quark, the strange quark couples to the charm quark. But you start looking at, say, strange decays, and the strange quark is perfectly happy to decay into the up quark. The strange will decay into the charm quark. It'll decay into the top quark if you have enough energy around. The quarks can weakly decay into one another. Now, mind you, they're all doing this SU3 thing for billions of SU3 lifetimes before the weak interaction sets in. You know, there are vastly different time scales here, so you can distinguish these things. But eventually, the quarks will decay weakly into other stuff. And these weak interaction terms, contradicting this form of action, actually allow the different quarks to decay into one another across the family. So that's awkward. The first thing you think to do, just like over here, is to stick a matrix in, you know, between two bar. Well, that's very complicated in this term. This term's already messy enough. You can accomplish the same thing by putting the off-diagonal stuff into the mass term. So what you do is you make the Yukawa term go to something like a mass matrix here. You've got your phi dagger coupling to some kind of a Q and a mass matrix Q prime phi Q prime. So this matrix is called the CKM matrix, the Kabibo Kobayashi Moskawa matrix. I think Kabibo early on introduced the rotation angle between the down and the strange quark. So the Kabibo angle was just it let D prime be a linear combination of the down and the strange quark. And say it here is called the Kabibo angle. So what could happen is if you put D prime into the weak interaction term, that would be enough to put a little bit of S coupling to the up quark. And you could have the S decaying into the up. And it doesn't matter whether you do this with the bottom one of the doublet or the top one of the doublet. As long as you mix one of them, it's unitary, so you can flip it onto the other one just the same. So, you know, it's nothing special about the down and strange versus the up and charm quark. It's just a convenient way to do it. Well, then Kobayashi and Moskawa, realized that
first off, you needed to do this. Well, no. The thing they recognized is that, let's see. There's
a whole history story here. Cronin and Fitch discovered CP violation in the K-naught decay. The K-naught meson violates both charge conjugation and parity. The combined symmetry CP is violated, which means that if the CPT theorem holds, time reversal violation is violated in weak interaction. Well, that kind of rocked the world. Everybody was all keen about that for quite a while, and they got their Nobel Prize, and that was cool. But then Kobayashi and Masawa realized that with only two families of quarks, at that point you had the up-down and the charm-strange quarks, the charm was still the prediction, I think, they realized that two families of quarks could not produce CP violations. You didn't have enough freedom in choosing, you know, just this one angle to produce a CP violating system. And they said, well, okay, one way you could fix this up is if there's a third family of quarks. So Kobayashi and Miskawa predicted the third family of quarks, the top one of quarks. And then they wrote a generalization of this matrix. It became a 3x3 matrix, mixing the three families now. That gave it four parameters, and there were enough parameters to produce CP violation. So their observation CP violation led them to predict two new particles that hadn't been even dreamed of yet. And when those particles were in fact discovered, Kobayashi and Miskawa won the Nobel Prize for the prediction. So that mixing matrix goes in here. We'll say more explicitly about that. But in order to give neutrino masses, you put the same kind of a matrix into the electron Yukawa term, and you can get neutrino masses. So probably the thing to do at this point is to try and write the correct version of the whole standard model action. Expand it out until we can see explicitly what the interactions are, that everything's getting appropriate masses, that parity is preserved by the electromagnetic interaction, and so on. And I invite you all to play with that. It's pretty much what I'll be doing until we finish it up. But